You must realize that.
I don't know what your advice will be when you hear the rest, said Kristen. The situation is such that Simon is too good to gnaw on the bare branch from which another man has broken off the blossom.
She looked directly at the monk. But when she met his eye and noticed how the dry, wrinkled old face suddenly changed and became filled with grief and horror, something seemed to break inside her. The tears poured out, and she tried to throw herself to her knees. But Edwin pulled her vehemently back. No, no. Sit down here on the chest with me. I cannot hear your confession. He moved aside to make room for her. Kristen continued to cry. He stroked her hand and said softly,
Do you remember that morning, Kristen, when I saw you for the first time on the stairs of Hamar Cathedral? I once heard a legend, when I was abroad, about a monk who could not believe that God loved all of us wretched, sinful souls. An angel came and touched his sight so that he saw a stone at the bottom of the sea, and under the stone lived a blind, white, naked creature. And the monk stared at the creature until he began to love it, because it was so small and pitiful. When I saw you sitting there, so tiny and pitiful inside that huge stone building, then I thought it was reasonable that God should love someone like you. You were lovely and pure, and yet you needed protection and help. I thought I saw the whole church with you inside it, lying in the hand of God.
Kristen said softly, We have bound ourselves to each other with the most solemn of oaths. And I have heard that such an agreement consecrates us before God just as much as if our parents had given us to each other.
But the monk replied with despair,
I see, Kristen, that someone has been telling you of the canonical law without fully understanding it. You could not promise yourself to this man without sinning against your parents. God placed them above you before you met him. And won't it also be a sorrow and a shame for this man's kinsmen if they learn that he has seduced the daughter of a man who has carried his shield with honor all these years? And you were also betrothed. I see that you do not think you have sinned so greatly, and yet you dare not confess this to your parish priest. And if you think you are as good as married to this man, why don't you wear the linen wimple instead of going around bareheaded among the young maidens, with whom you have so little in common now? For now your thoughts must be on other things than theirs are.
I don't know what I'm thinking about, said Kristen wearily. It's true that all my thoughts are with this man, whom I yearn for. If it weren't for father and mother, then I would gladly pin up my hair on this very day. I wouldn't care if they called me a paramour, if only I could be called his.
Do you know whether this man's intentions are such that you might be his with honor some day?
Asked Brother Edwin.
Then Kristen told him about everything that had happened between Erland Nicolason and herself, and as she talked, she seemed to have forgotten that she had ever doubted the outcome of the whole matter. Don't you see, Brother Edwin? She continued. We couldn't control ourselves. God help me, if I met him here outside the church, after I leave you, I would go with him if he asked me to. And you should know that I have now seen that other people have sinned as we have. When I was back home, I couldn't understand how anything could have such power over the souls of people that they would forget all fear of sin. But now I have seen so much that if one cannot rectify the sins one has committed out of desire or anger, then heaven must be a desolate place. They say that you too once struck a man in anger.
That's true, said the monk. And it is only through God's mercy that I am not called a murderer. That was many years ago. I was a young man back then, and I didn't think I could tolerate the injustice that the bishop wished to exercise against us poor brothers. King Hakon, he was the duke at that time, had given us the land for our building, but we were so poor that we had to do the work on our church ourselves, with the help of a few workmen who lent a hand more for their reward in heaven than for what we were able to pay them. Perhaps it was arrogance on the part of the mendicant monks that we wanted to build our church with such splendor. But we were as happy as children in the meadows, singing hymns as we chiseled and built walls and toiled. May God bless Brother Ranulf. He was a master builder, a skilled stonemason. I think God himself had granted this man all his knowledge and skills. I was cutting altar pieces from stone back then. I had finished one of St. Clara, with the angels leading her to the church of St. Francis early Christmas morning. It had turned out beautifully, and we all rejoiced over it. Then those cowardly devils tore down the walls, and the stones toppled and crushed my altar pieces. I lunged at a man with a hammer. I couldn't control myself. Yes, I see that you're smiling, Kristen. But don't you realize how badly things stand with you now? For you would rather hear about other people's frailties than about the deeds of decent people, which might serve as an example for you. As Kristen was about to leave, Brother Edvin said, It's not easy to advise you. If you were to do what's right, then you would bring sorrow to your parents and shame upon your entire lineage. But you must try to win release from your promise to Simon Andresen. Then you must wait patiently for the joy that God will send you. Do penance in your heart as best you can, and do not let this Erlan tempt you to sin more often. But ask him lovingly to seek reconciliation with your kinsmen and with God. I cannot absolve you of your sin, said Brother Edvin as they parted. But I will pray for you with all my heart. Then he placed his thin old hands on Kristen's head and said a prayer of blessing and peace for her in farewell. Chapter 6 Afterward, Kristen could not remember everything that Brother Edvin had said to her, but she left him with a strange feeling of clarity and serene peace in her soul. Before, she had struggled with a hollow and secret fear, trying to defy it. Her sin had not been so great. Now she felt that Edvin had shown her clearly and lucidly that she had indeed sinned, that such and such were her sins, and that she would have to take them upon her shoulders and try to bear them with patience and dignity. She strove to think of Erlan without impatience, in spite of the fact that he had sent no word and she missed his caresses. She simply had to be faithful and full of kindness toward him. She thought about her parents and promised herself that she would repay all their love after they had first recovered from the sorrow that she was going to cause them by breaking with the Diefrin people. And she thought most about Brother Edvin's advice that she should not seek solace by looking at the failings of others. She felt herself growing humble and kind, and soon realized how easy it was for her to win the friendship of others. At once she felt consoled that it was not so difficult, after all, to get along with people. And then she thought that it shouldn't be so difficult for her and Erlan either. Up until the day when she gave Erlan her promise, she had always tried diligently to do everything that was right and good. But she had done everything at the bidding of other people. Now she felt that she had grown up from maiden to woman. This was not just because of the passionate, secret caresses she had received and given. She had not merely left her father's guardianship and subjected herself to Erlan's will. Brother Edvin had impressed on her the responsibility of answering for her own life, and for Erlan's as well, and she was willing to bear this burden with grace and dignity. So she lived among the nuns during the Christmas season. During the beautiful services and amidst the joy and peace, she no doubt felt herself unworthy, but she consoled herself with the belief that the time would soon come when she would be able to redeem herself again. But on the day after New Year's, Sir Andres Dare arrived unexpectedly at the convent, together with his wife and all 5 children. They were going to spend the last part of the Christmas holidays with friends and kinsmen in town, and they came to ask Kristen to join them at the place where they were staying for several days. "I've been thinking, my daughter," said Fru Angerd,
that you probably wouldn't mind seeing some new faces by now.
The Defrin people were staying in a beautiful house that was part of an estate near the Bishop's Citadel. Sir Andre's nephew owned it. There was a large room where the servants slept, and a magnificent loft room with a brick fireplace and three good beds. Sir Andres and Fru Angerd slept in one of the beds, along with their youngest son, Gudmund, who was still a child. Kristen and their two daughters, Astri and Sigrid, slept in the second bed. And in the third slept Simon and his older brother, Geird Andresen. All of Sir Andres' children were good-looking, Simon the least so, and yet people still considered him handsome. And Kristen noticed even more that when she had been at the Defrin Manor the year before, that both his parents and his four siblings listened closely to Simon and did everything he wished. All his kinsmen loved each other heartily, but agreed without rancor to place Simon foremost. These people led a joyful and happy life, going to one of the churches each day to make their offerings, meeting to drink among friends each evening, and allowing the young to play and dance. Everyone showed Kristen the greatest kindness, and no one seemed to notice how little joy she felt. At night, when the candles were put out in the loft and everyone had gone to bed, Simon would get up and come over to where the maidens lay. He would sit for a while on the edge of the bed, speaking mostly to his sisters, but in the dark he would sneak his hand up to Kristen's breast and let it stay there. She would lie there, sweating with indignation. Now that her sense for such matters was so much keener, she realized that there were many things that Simon was both too proud and too shy to say to her, once he noticed that she didn't want to go into such topics. And she felt a strange, bitter anger toward him, because it seemed to her that he was trying to make himself seem a better man than the one who had taken her, even though he had no idea of the other man's existence. But one evening when they had been out dancing at another estate, Astri and Sigrid stayed behind and were going to sleep with a foster sister. Late that night, when the people from Defrin had gone to bed in the loft, Simon came over to Kristen's bed and climbed in. He lay on top of the furs. Kristen pulled the covers up to her chin and crossed her arms tightly over her chest. After a moment, Simon reached out his hand to touch her breasts. She felt the silk embroidery at his wrists, so she realized that he had not undressed. "You're just as shy in the dark as in the daylight, Kristen," said Simon with a chuckle. "Surely you'll let me hold your hand, won't you?" he asked, and Kristen gave him her fingertips. "Don't you think we might have a few things to talk about, now that we have the chance to be alone for a little while?" he said. And Kristen thought that now she would be able to speak, so she agreed. But then she could not utter a word. "Can I come under the furs?" he asked again. "It's cold in the room." And he slipped in between the furs and the woolen blanket she had over her. He crooked one arm behind her head, but in such a way that he did not touch her. And they lay there like that for a while. "You're not an easy person to woo either," said Simon after a pause, and then laughed in resignation. "I promise you I won't so much as kiss you, if you don't want me to. But surely you can talk to me, can't you?" Kristen moistened her lips with the tip of her tongue, but she still remained silent. "It seems to me that you're lying here trembling," Simon continued. "Is it because you have something against me, Kristen?" She didn't think that she could lie to Simon, so she said, "No." But nothing more. Simon lay there a little longer, trying to get a conversation started. But finally he laughed again and said, "I see that you think I should be satisfied with this, that you have nothing against me, for tonight at least, and that I should even be happy. It's strange how proud you are, too. But you must give me a kiss all the same. Then I'll go and not plague you any longer." He took his kiss, sat up, and set his feet on the floor. Kristen thought that now she would manage to tell him what had to be said. But he had already left her bed, and she could hear him getting undressed. The next day, Fru Angerd was not as friendly toward Kristen as she usually was.
The young maiden realized that she must have heard something and felt that the betrothed girl had not received her son in the manner that his mother felt she should have. Later in the afternoon, Simon mentioned that he was thinking of trading for a horse that was owned by one of his friends. He asked Kristen whether she would like to go along and watch. She said yes, and they went into town together. The weather was clear and beautiful. It had snowed a little during the night, but now the sun was shining, and it was still so cold that the snow squeaked under their feet. Kristen enjoyed getting out in the cold and walking, so when Simon had found the horse that he was thinking of, she talked to him about it in the most lively manner. She had some knowledge of horses, since she had always spent so much time with her father. And this one was a fine animal, a mouse-gray stallion with narrow black stripes along his back and a short-clipped mane. He was well-built and spirited, but quite small and slight.
"He won't last long under a fully armed man," said Kristen.
"No. But that's not what I had in mind either," said Simon. He led the horse out to the open area behind the farm, let him run and walk, rode the animal himself, and then had Kristen ride him too. They stayed outdoors in the white pasture for a long time. Finally, as Kristen was feeding bread to the horse from her hand, Simon leaned against the animal with his arm over his back and said suddenly, "Seems to me, Kristen, that you and my mother have been rather cross with each other."
"I haven't meant to be cross with your mother," she said, "but I can't find much to say to Fru Angerd."
"You don't seem to find much to say to me either," said Simon. "I won't force myself on you, Kristen, before the time comes. But things can't go on like this. I never get a chance to talk to you."
"I have never been talkative," said Kristen. "I know that myself. And I don't expect you to think it a great loss if things don't work out between us."
"You know what I think about that subject," replied Simon, looking at her. Kristen blushed as red as blood, and she was startled to find that she was not averse to Simon Dari's wooing. After a moment, he said, "Is it Arne Geirdsen, Kristen, that you think you can't forget?"
Kristen stared at him.
Simon continued, and his voice was kind and understanding. "I won't blame you for that. You grew up as siblings, and barely a year has passed. But you can depend on this. I want only what's best for you."
Kristen's face had grown quite pale. Neither of them spoke as they walked through town in the twilight. At the end of the street, in the greenish-blue sky, the crescent of the new moon hung with a bright star in its embrace. 1 year, thought Kristen, and she could hardly remember when she had last given Arna a thought. It gave her a fright. Maybe she was a loose, vile woman. 1 year since she had seen him lying on the bier in the death chamber, when she thought she would never be happy again. She whimpered silently in fear at the inconstancy of her own heart and at the transitory nature of all things. Erlan. Would he forget her? But worse yet was that she might ever forget him. King Andres and his children went to the great Christmas celebration at the king's castle. Kristen saw all the finery and splendor, and they were also invited into the hall where King Håkon sat with Fru Isabel Bruce, the widow of King Eirik. Sir Andres went forward to greet the king, while his children and Kristen remained behind. She thought of everything that Fru Asiel had told her, and she remembered that the king was Erlan's close kinsman. Their father's mothers had been sisters. And she was Erlan's wife by seduction. She had no right to stand here, especially not among these good, fine people, the children of Sir Andres. Suddenly, she saw Erlan Nikolausen. He had stepped forward in front of Queen Isabel and was standing there with his head bowed and his hand on his breast while she spoke a few words to him. He was wearing the brown silk surcoat that he had worn to their banquet rendezvous. Kristen stepped behind Sir Andres' daughters. When Fru Angerd, some time later, escorted the three maidens over to the queen, Kristen could not see Erlan anywhere, but she didn't dare raise her eyes from the floor. She wondered if he was standing somewhere in the hall.
She thought she could feel his eyes on her. But she also thought that everyone was staring at her, as if they could tell that she was standing there like a liar with the gold wreath on her hair, which fell loosely over her shoulders. He was not in the hall where the young people were served dinner and where they danced after the tables had been cleared away. Kristen had to dance with Simon that evening. Along one wall stood a built-in table, and that's where the king's servants set ale and mead and wine all night long. Once, when Simon took Kristen over there and drank a toast to her, she saw that Erlon was standing quite close to her, behind Simon. He looked at her, and Kristen's hand shook as Simon gave her the goblet, and she raised it to her lips. Erlon whispered fiercely to the man who was with him, a tall, heavy-set, but handsome older man, who shook his head dismissively with an angry expression. In the next moment, Simon led Kristen back to the dance. She had no idea how long that dance lasted. The ballad seemed endless, and every moment was tedious and painful with longing and unrest. At last it was over, and Simon escorted her over to the table for drinks again. One of his friends approached and spoke to him, leading him away a few paces, over to a group of young men. Then Erlon stood before her.
"I have so much I want to say to you," he whispered. "I don't know what to say first. In Christ's name, Kristen, how are things with you?"
he asked hastily, for he noticed that her face had turned as white as chalk. She couldn't see him clearly. It was as if there was running water between their faces. He picked up a goblet from the table, drank from it, and handed it to Kristen. She thought it was much too heavy, or that her arm had been pulled from its socket. She couldn't manage to raise it to her lips.
"Is that how things stand? That you'll drink with your betrothed, but not with me?"
asked Erlon softly. But Kristen dropped the goblet and swooned forward into his arms. When she woke up, she was lying on a bench with her head in the lap of a maiden she didn't know. They had loosened her belt and the brooch on her breast. Someone was slapping her hands, and her face was wet. She sat up. Somewhere in the circle of people around her, she saw Erlon's face, pale and ill. She felt weak herself, as if all her bones had melted, and her head felt huge and hollow. But somewhere in her mind, a single thought, clear and desperate, shone. She had to talk to Erlon. Then she said to Simon Dara, who was standing close by, "It must have been too hot for me. There are so many candles burning in here, and I'm not accustomed to drinking so much wine."
"Are you all right now?" asked Simon. "You frightened everyone. Perhaps you would like me to take you home?"
"I think we should wait until your parents leave," said Kristen calmly, "but sit down here. I don't feel like dancing anymore." She patted the cushion beside her. Then she stretched out her other hand to Erlon. "Sit down here, Erlon Nikolason. I didn't have a chance to give you my full greeting. Ingeborg was just saying lately that she thought you had forgotten all about her." She saw that he was having a much more difficult time composing himself than she was. It cost her great effort to hold back the tender little smile that threatened to appear on her lips.
"You must thank the maiden for still remembering me," he said, stammering. "And here I was so afraid that she had forgotten me."
Kristen hesitated for a moment. She didn't know what message she could bring from the flighty Ingeborg that would be interpreted correctly by Erlon. Then bitterness rose up inside her for all those months of helplessness, and she said, "Dear Erlon, did you think that we maidens would forget the man who so magnificently defended our honor?" She saw that he looked as if she had struck him, and she regretted it at once when Simon asked what she meant. Kristen told him of her adventure with Ingeborg out in the Eikeberg woods. She noticed that Simon was not pleased. Then she asked him to go in search of Fru Angerd to see if they would be leaving soon. She was tired after all. When he had gone, she turned to look at Erland.
"It's odd," he said in a low voice, "how resourceful you are. I wouldn't have thought it of you."
"I've had to learn to conceal things, as you might well imagine," she said somberly. Erlon breathed heavily. He was still quite pale.
"Is that it?" he whispered. "But you promised to go to my friends if that should come about." "God knows. I've thought about you every single day, about whether the worst had happened."
"I know what you mean by the worst," replied Kristen tersely. "You needn't worry about that. It seems worse to me that you would not send me a word of greeting. Can't you understand that I'm living there with the nuns like some strange bird?"
She stopped because she could feel the tears rising. "Is that why you're with the Diefrin people now?" he asked.
Then she grew so full of despair that she couldn't answer. She saw Fru Angerd and Simon appear in the doorway. Erlon's hand lay on his knee, close to her own, but she could not touch it.
"I have to talk to you," he said fiercely. "We haven't said a word to each other about what we should have talked about."
"Come to the Mass at the Maria Church after the last day of the Christmas season," Kristen said hastily, as she stood up and stepped forward to meet the others. Fru Angerd was quite loving and kind toward Kristen on the way home, and she helped the maiden into bed herself. Kristen didn't have a chance to speak to Simon until the following day. Then he said, "How is it that you would agree to convey messages between this Erland and Ingeborg Philippa's daughter? You should not lend a hand in this matter if they have some secret business between them."
"I don't think there's anything behind it," said Kristen. "She's just a chatterbox."
"I thought you would have been more sensible," said Simon, "and to venture into the woods and out onto the roads alone with that magpie." But Kristen reminded him with some fervor that it was not their fault they had gone astray. Simon didn't say another word. The next day, the Diefrin people escorted her back to the convent before setting off for home themselves. Erland came to Vespers at the convent church every day for a week, but Kristen didn't have the chance to exchange a single word with him. She felt as if she were a hawk that sat chained to a roost with a hood pulled over its eyes. She was also unhappy about every word they had said to each other at their last meeting. That was not the way it was supposed to have been. It didn't help that she told herself it had happened so suddenly for both of them that they hardly knew what they were saying. But one afternoon, at dusk, a beautiful woman who looked like the wife of a townsman appeared in the parlatory. She asked for Kristen Lavran's daughter and said that she was the wife of a clothing merchant. Her husband had just arrived from Denmark with some fine cloaks, and Osmund Bjørgulfsson wished to give one of them to his niece, so the maiden was to go with her to select it herself. Kristen was allowed to accompany the woman. She thought it unlike her uncle to want to give her a costly gift, and peculiar that he would send a stranger to get her. At first, the woman said little, replying only briefly to Kristen's questions, but when they had walked all the way into town, she suddenly said, "I don't want to fool you, lovely child that you are. I'm going to tell you how things truly stand so you can decide for yourself. It wasn't your uncle who sent me, but a man. Maybe you can guess his name, and if you can't, then you shouldn't come with me. I have no husband, and I have to make a living for myself and mine by keeping an inn and serving ale, so I can't be too afraid of either sin or servants. But I will not let my house be used for purposes of deceiving you within my walls." Kristen stopped, her face flushed. She felt strangely hurt and ashamed on Erland's behalf. The woman said, "I will accompany you back to the convent, Kristen, but you must give me something for my trouble. The knight promised me a large reward, but I was also beautiful once, and I too was deceived. And then you can remember me in your prayers tonight. They call me Brynhild Fluga." Kristen took a ring from her finger and gave it to the woman.
"That was kind of you, Brynhild, but if the man is my kinsman Erland Nicolason, then I have nothing to fear. He wants me to reconcile him with my uncle. You will not be blamed. But thank you for warning me."
Brynhild Fluga turned away to hide her smile. She led Kristen through the alleys behind Clemens Church and north toward the river. A few small, isolated farms were situated on the bank. They walked between several fences, and there came Erland to meet them. He glanced around and then took off his cape and wrapped it around Kristen, pulling the hood forward over her face.
What do you think of this ruse? He asked quickly in a low voice. Do you think I've done wrong? But I had to talk to you.
It won't do much good for us to think about what's right and what's wrong, said Kristen.
Don't talk like that, implored Erlan. I take the blame. Kristen, I've longed for you every day and every night, he whispered close to her ear.
A shudder passed through her as she briefly met his glance. She felt guilty because she had been thinking about something besides her love for him when he looked at her in that way. Brynhild Fluga had gone on ahead. When they reached the inn, Erland asked Kristen,
Do you want to go into the main room? Or should we talk upstairs in the loft?
As you please, replied Kristen.
It's cold up there, said Erland softly. We'll have to get into the bed.
Kristen merely nodded. The instant he had closed the door behind them, she was in his arms. He bent her this way and that like a wand, blinding her and smothering her with kisses, as he impatiently tore both cloaks off her and tossed them to the floor. Then he lifted the girl in the pale convent dress in his arms, pressing her to his shoulder, and carried her over to the bed. Frightened by his roughness and by her own sudden desire for this man, she put her arms around him and buried her face in his neck. It was so cold in the loft that they could see their own breath like a cloud of smoke in front of the little candle standing on the table. But there were plenty of blankets and furs on the bed, covered by a great bearskin, which they pulled all the way up over their faces. She didn't know how long she had lain like that in his arms when Erlan said,
Now we must talk about those things that have to be discussed, my Kristen. I don't dare keep you here long.
I'll stay here the whole night if you want me to, whispered Kristen.
Erlan pressed his cheek to hers. Then I would not be much of a friend to you. Things are bad enough already, but I won't have people gossiping about you because of me.
Kristen didn't reply, but she felt a twinge of pain. She didn't understand how he could say such a thing, since he was the one who had brought her here to Brynhild Fluga's house. She didn't know how she knew it, but she realized that this was not a good place. And he had expected that everything would proceed just as it did, for he had a cup of mead standing inside the bed drapes.
I've been thinking, continued Erlan, that if there's no other alternative, then I'll have to take you away by force to Sweden. Duchess Ingebjerg received me kindly this autumn and spoke of the kinship between us. But now I'm paying for my sins. I've fled the country before, you know. And I don't want you to be mentioned as that other one's equal.
Take me home to Husaby with you, said Kristen quietly. I can't bear to be separated from you and to live with the maidens in the convent. Surely both your kinsmen and mine will be reasonable enough that they'll allow us to be together and become reconciled with them.
Erland hugged her tight and moaned, I can't take you to Husaby, Kristen.
Why can't you?
She asked in a whisper. Eline came back this fall, he said after a moment. I can't make her leave the farm, he continued angrily. Not unless I carry her by force out to the sleigh and drive her away myself. And I don't think I could do that. She brought both of our children home with her.
Kristen felt as if she were sinking deeper and deeper. In a voice that was brittle with fear, she said, I thought you had parted from her.
I thought so too, replied Erland curtly. But she apparently heard in Ørstedal, where she was living, that I was thinking of marriage. You saw the man I was with at the Christmas banquet. That was my foster father, Bard Pettersson of Hestnes. I went to him when I returned from Sweden. I visited my kinsman, Hemming Alvsson, in Saltvik too. I told them that I wanted to get married now and asked them to help me. That must be what Elina heard. I told her to demand whatever she wanted for herself and the children. But they don't expect Sigurd, her husband, to survive the winter. And then no one can prevent us from living together. I slept in the stables with Haftor and Ulf, and Elina slept in the house in my bed. I think my men had a good laugh behind my back.
Kristen couldn't say a word. After a moment, Erlan went on.
You know, on the day when our betrothal is formally celebrated, She'll have to realize that it will do her no good, that she has no power over me any longer. But it will be bad for the children. I hadn't seen them in a year. They're good-looking children. And there's little I can do to secure their situation. It wouldn't have helped them much, even if I had been able to marry their mother.
Tears began to slide down Kristen's cheeks. Then Erlan said,
Did you hear what I said? That I have spoken to my kinsmen? And they were pleased that I want to marry. Then I told them that it was you I wanted and no one else.
And weren't they pleased about that? Asked Kristen at last, timidly.
Don't you see, said Erlan gloomily, that there was only one thing they could say? They cannot and they will not ride with me to speak with your father until this agreement between you and Simon Anderson has been dissolved. It hasn't made things any easier for us, Kristen, that you have celebrated Christmas with the different people.
Kristen broke down completely and began to sob quietly. She had no doubt felt that there was something unwise and ignoble about her love, and now she realized that the blame was hers. She shivered with cold as she got out of bed a short time later, and Erlan wrapped both cloaks around her. It was now completely dark outside, and Erlan accompanied her to Clement's churchyard. Then Brynhild escorted her the rest of the way to Nonnesetter. Chapter 7 The following week, Brynhild Fluga came with word that the cloak was now finished, and Kristen went with her and was with Erland in the loft room as before. When they parted, he gave her a cloak.
So you have something to show at the convent, he said.
It was made of blue velvet interwoven with red silk, and Erland asked her whether she noticed that they were the same colors as the dress she had worn on that day in the forest. Kristen was surprised that she could be so happy over what he said. She felt as if he had never given her greater joy than with those words. But now they could no longer use this excuse to meet, and it was not easy to think of something else. Erlan went to Vespers at the convent church, and several times after the service, Kristen went on an errand up to the Carodians' farms. They stole a few words with each other up along the fences in the dark of the winter evening. Then Kristen thought of asking Sister Potencia for permission to visit several palsied old women, charity cases at the convent, who lived in a house out in a field some distance away. Behind the house was a shed where the women kept a cow. Kristen offered to tend to the animal for them when she visited, and then she would let Erlan come in while she worked. She noticed with some surprise that in spite of Erlan's joy at being with her, a tiny scrap of bitterness had settled in his mind that she had been able to think up this excuse.
It was not to your best advantage that you became acquainted with me, he said one evening. Now you've learned to use these kinds of secret ruses.
You should not be blaming me for that, replied Kristen dejectedly.
It's not you that I blame, said Erland at once, embarrassed.
I never thought, she went on, that it would be so easy for me to lie. But what must be done can be done.
That's not always true, said Erland in the same voice as before. Do you remember this past winter, when you couldn't tell your betrothed that you wouldn't have him?
Kristen didn't reply, but merely stroked his face. She never felt so strongly how much she loved Erland as when he said such things that made her feel dejected or surprised. And she was glad that she could take the blame for everything that was disgraceful or ignoble about their love. If she had had the courage to speak to Simon as she should have, then they could have progressed a long way in settling these matters. Erland had done all that he could when he had spoken of marriage to his kinsmen. This is what she told herself whenever the days at the convent grew long and dreary. Erland had wanted to make everything right and proper. With tender little smiles, she would think about him as he looked whenever he described their wedding. She would ride to the church dressed in silk and velvet, and she would be led to the bridal bed with a tall golden crown on her hair, which would be spread out over her shoulders. Her lovely, beautiful hair, he said, running her braids through his fingers.
But for you, it wouldn't be the same as if you had never possessed me,
Kristen once said thoughtfully when he had spoken of such things. Then he had pulled her ardently to him.
Don't you think I can remember the first time I celebrated Christmas? Or the first time I saw the mountainsides turn green back home after winter? Oh, of course I'll remember the first time I had you, and every time after that. But to possess you, that's like perpetually celebrating Christmas, or hunting birds on the green slopes.
Joyfully, she crept closer in his arms. Not that she for a moment believed that things would go as Erland so confidently expected. Kristen thought that a judgment day was sure to befall them before long. It was impossible for things to continue to go so well. But she was not particularly afraid. She was much more frightened that Erland might have to travel north before the matter could be settled, and she would have to stay behind, separated from him. He was over at the fortress on Akershness right now. Munan Bardson was there while the royal treasurer was in Tunsberg, where the king lay deathly ill. But one day Erland would no doubt have to return home to see to his property. She refused to admit that this frightened her because he would be going home to Husaby where his mistress was waiting for him. But she was less afraid of being caught in sin with Erland than of standing up alone and telling Simon, and her father as well, what was in her heart. And so she almost wished that some punishment would befall her, and soon. For now she had no thoughts for anything but Erland. She longed for him in the daytime, and she dreamed of him at night. She felt no repentance, but she consoled herself with the thought that the day would come when she would have to pay dearly for everything they had taken in secret. And during those brief evening hours when she could be together with Erland in the poor women's cowshed, she would throw herself into his arms so ardently, as if she had paid with her soul to be his. But time passed, and it looked as if Erland was to have the good fortune that he was counting on. Kristen noticed that no one at the convent ever suspected her, although Ingebjerg had discovered that she met with Erland. But Kristen could see that the other girl never thought it was anything more than a little amusement she was allowing herself. That a betrothed maiden of good family would dare to break the agreement that her kinsman had made was something that would never occur to Ingebjerg. And for a moment, fear raced through Kristen once more. Perhaps this was something completely unheard of, this situation she had landed in. And then she wished again that she would be found out so that it could be brought to an end. Easter arrived. Kristen couldn't understand what had happened to the winter. Each day that she had not seen Erland had been as long as a dismal year, and the long gloomy days had become linked together into endless weeks. But now it was spring and Easter, and it seemed to her as if they had just celebrated Christmas. She asked Erland not to seek her out during the holidays, and it seemed to Kristen that he acquiesced to all her wishes. It was just as much her fault as his that they had sinned against the strictures of Lent. But she wanted them to observe the Easter holiday, even though it hurt not to see him. He might have to leave quite soon. He hadn't said anything about it, but she knew that the king was now dying, and she thought that this might cause some change in Erland's position. This was how matters stood for Kristen when, a few days after Easter, she was summoned down to the parlatory to speak with her betrothed. As soon as Simon came toward her and put out his hand, she realized that something was wrong. His face was not the same as usual. His small gray eyes weren't laughing, and they were untouched by his smile. Kristen couldn't help noticing that it suited him to be a little less jovial. And he looked quite handsome in the traveling clothes he wore, a long, blue, tight-fitting outer garment that men called a coat-hardy, and a brown shoulder cape with a hood, which he had thrown back. His light brown hair was quite curly from the raw, damp air. They sat and talked for a while. Simon had been at Formo during Lent, and he was over at Uringard almost daily. They were all well there. Ulvil was as healthy as anyone could expect. Romborg was home now. She was charming and lively. "The time is almost over,"
The year that you were supposed to spend here at Nonaceter, said Simon. They're probably preparing everything for our betrothal feast at your home.
Kristen didn't reply as Simon continued.
I told Lavrans that I would ride to Oslo to speak with you about it.
Kristen looked down and said quietly, Things are such, Simon, that I would prefer to speak with you in private about this matter.
I too have felt that this would be necessary, replied Simon Andersen. I was going to ask that you obtain Fru Groa's permission for us to walk in the garden together.
Kristen stood up abruptly and slipped soundlessly out of the room. A short time later she returned, accompanied by one of the nuns with a key. A door from the parlatory opened onto the herb garden, which lay beyond the buildings on the west side of the convent. The nun unlocked the door, and they stepped out into a fog so dense that they could see only a few steps in front of them amidst the trees. The closest trunks were black as coal. Beads of moisture clung to every branch and twig. Small patches of new snow were melting on the wet soil, but beneath the bushes, tiny white and yellow lilies had already sprouted flowers, and it smelled fresh and cool from the violet grass. Simon led her to the nearest bench. He sat down, leaning forward slightly with his elbows propped on his knees. Then he looked up at her with an odd little smile.
I almost think I know what you want to tell me, he said. There's another man that you like better than me?
That is true, replied Kristen softly.
I think I know his name, too, said Simon, his voice more harsh. Is it Erland Nikolausen of Husaby?
After a moment, Kristen said in a low voice, So this has come to your attention?
Simon hesitated before he answered. Surely you can't think me so stupid that I wouldn't notice anything when we were together at Christmas time? I couldn't say anything then, because my father and mother were present. But this is the reason that I wanted to come here alone this time. I don't know whether it's wise of me to speak of this matter, but I thought that we ought to talk of such things before we are joined in marriage. But as it happened, when I arrived here yesterday, I met my kinsman, Master Erstein, and he spoke of you. He said that he saw you walking across Clement's churchyard one evening, and that you were with a woman they call Brynhild Fluga. I swore a sacred oath that he must have been mistaken. And if you tell me that it's untrue, I will take you at your word.
The priest was right, replied Kristen stubbornly. You forswore yourself, Simon. He sat in silence for a moment before he spoke again.
Do you know who this Brynhild Fluga is, Kristen?
When she shook her head, he said,
Munan Bardson set her up in a house here in town after he was married. She sells wine illegally and other such things.
Do you know her?
Asked Kristen derisively. I've never been inclined to become a monk or a priest, said Simon, turning red. But I know that I have never acted unjustly toward a maiden or another man's wife. Don't you realize that it's not the conduct of an honorable man to allow you to go out at night in such company?
Erland did not seduce me, said Kristen, blushing and indignant. And he has promised me nothing. I set my heart on him, though he did nothing to tempt me. I loved him above all men from the first moment I saw him.
Simon sat there, playing with his dagger, tossing it from one hand to the other. These are strange words to be hearing from one's betrothed, he said. This does not bode well for us now, Kristen.
Kristen took a deep breath. You would be poorly served to take me for your wife, Simon.
Almighty God knows that this seems to be so, said Simon Andersen.
Then I trust that you will support me, said Kristen, meek and timid, so that Sir Andres and my father will retract this agreement between us.
Oh, is that what you think? Said Simon.
He was silent for a moment.
God only knows whether you truly understand what you're saying.
I do, Kristen told him. I know that the law is such that no one can force a maiden into a marriage against her will. Then she can bring her case before the ting.
I think it's before the bishop, said Simon, smiling harshly. but I've never had any reason to look into what the law says about such matters. And don't think you'll have any need to do so either. You know I won't demand that you keep your promise if you're so strongly opposed to it. But don't you realize? It's been 2 years since our betrothal was agreed upon, and you've never said a word against it until now, when everything is being prepared for the betrothal banquet and the wedding. Have you thought about what it will mean if you step forward and ask for the bond to be broken, Kristen?
You wouldn't want me now anyway, said Kristen.
Yes, I would, replied Simon curtly. If you think otherwise, you had better think again.
Erland Nikolaussen and I have promised ourselves on our Christian faith, she said, trembling, that if we cannot be joined in marriage, then neither of us will ever take a husband or a wife.
Simon was silent for a long time. Then he said wearily,
Then I don't understand what you meant, Kristen, when you said that he had neither seduced you nor promised you anything. He has lured you away from the council of all your kinsmen. Have you thought about what kind of husband you'll have if you marry a man who took another man's wife as his mistress? And now he wants to take as his wife another man's betrothed.
Kristen swallowed her tears, whispering in a thick voice,
You're saying this to hurt me.
Do you think I want to hurt you? Asked Simon softly.
This is not how things would have been if you...
Kristen said hesitantly.
You were never asked either, Simon. It was your father and mine who decided on this marriage. It would have been different if you had chosen me yourself.
Simon drove his dagger into the bench so that it stood upright. After a moment, he pulled it out and tried to slip it back into its scabbard. But it refused to go in because the tip was bent. Then he went back to fumbling with it, tossing it from one hand to the other.
You know very well, he said, his voice low and shaking. You know that you would be lying if you tried to pretend that I didn't. You know quite well what I wanted to talk to you about many times, but you received me in such a way that I wouldn't have been a man if I had mentioned it afterward. Not if they tried to draw it out of me with burning tongs. At first, I thought it was the dead boy. I thought I should give you some time. You didn't know me? I thought it would be harmful to you, such a short time after. Now I see that you didn't need long to forget. And now... Now. Now.
No, said Kristen quietly. I understand, Simon. I can't expect you to be my friend any longer.
Friend?
Simon gave an odd little laugh. Are you in need of my friendship now?
Kristen blushed. You're a man now, she said softly, and old enough. You can decide on your own marriage.
Simon gave her a sharp look. Then he laughed as he had before.
I see. You want me to say that I'm the one who... I should take the blame for this breach of promise? If it's true that you are set in your decision, if you dare and are determined to press your case, then I will do it, he said softly. My family back home and before all your kinsmen, except one. You will have to tell your father the truth, such as it is. If you wish, I will take your message to him and make it as easy for you as I can. But Lavrans Bjørgolfsson must know that I would never go against a promise that I have made to him.
Kristen gripped the edge of the bench with both hands. This affected her more strongly than everything else Simon Dara had said. Pale and frightened, she glanced up at him. Simon stood up.
We must go in now, he said. I think we're both freezing, and the sister is waiting for us with the key. I'll give you a week to think things over. I have some business here in town. I'll come back to talk to you before I leave, but I doubt you'll want to see me before then.
Chapter 8 So that was finally settled, Kristen told herself. But she felt exhausted, drained, and sick with yearning for Erland's arms. She lay awake most of the night,
and she decided to do what she had never before dared. She would send a message to Erlan. It wasn't easy to find someone who could carry out this errand for her. The lay sisters never went out alone, and she couldn't think of anyone she knew who would do it. The men who did the farm work were older and seldom came near the nun's residence, except to speak with the abbess. So Olav was the only one. He was a half-grown boy who worked in the gardens. He had been Fru Groa's foster son ever since he was found one morning as a newborn infant on the steps of the church. People said his mother was one of the lay sisters. She was supposed to become a nun, but after she had sat in the dark cell for 6 months, for gross disobedience, it was said, and that was after the child was found, she was given lay sister garb, and since then she had worked in the farmyard. During the past months, Kristen had often thought about Sister Ingrid's fate, but she had never had the chance to talk to her. It was risky to count on Olav. He was only a child, and Fru Groa and all the nuns talked to him and teased him whenever they saw him. But Kristen thought she had very little left to lose. And a couple of days later, when Olav was about to go into town one morning, Kristen asked him to take her message out to Akershus, telling Erlan to find some excuse so they could meet alone. That same afternoon, Ulv, Erlan's own servant, appeared at the speaking gate. He said he was Osman Björgulfsson's man and had been sent by his master to ask whether Osman's niece might come into town for a while, because he didn't have time to come up to Nonnesetter himself. Kristen thought this would never work, but when Sister Potencia asked her whether she knew the messenger, she said yes. So she went with Ulv over to Brynhild Fluga's house. Erlan was waiting for her in the loft. He was nervous and tense, and Kristen realized at once that he was again afraid of the one thing that he seemed to fear most. She always felt a pang in her heart that he should be so terrified that she might be carrying a child, when they couldn't seem to stay away from each other. So anxious was she feeling that evening that she said as much to him, quite angrily. Erlan's face turned dark red. He lay his head on her shoulder. "You're right," he said. "I should try to leave you alone, Kristen, and not keep testing your luck in this way. If you want me to." She threw her arms around him and laughed, but he clasped her tightly around the waist and pressed her down onto a bench. Then he sat down on the other side of the table. When she reached her hand across to him, he impetuously kissed her palm. "I've been trying harder than you have," he said fiercely. "If you only knew how important I think it is for both of us that we be married with full honor."
"Then you should not have taken me," said Kristen.
Erlan hid his face in his hands.
"No, I wish to God that I hadn't done you this wrong," he said.
"Neither one of us wishes that," said Kristen with a giddy laugh. "And as long as I can be reconciled and make peace in the end with my family and with God, then I won't grieve if I have to be wed wearing the wimple of a married woman. As long as I can be with you, I often think that I could even do without peace."
"You're going to bring honor back to my manor," said Erlan. "I'm not going to pull you down into my disgrace."
Kristen shook her head. Then she said, "You'll be glad to hear that I have spoken to Simon Andresen. And he's not going to bind me to the agreements that were made for us before I met you." Erlan was jubilant, and Kristen had to tell him everything, although she kept to herself the derogatory words that Simon had spoken about Erlan. But she did mention that he refused to let Lavrans think he was the one to blame.
"That's reasonable," said Erlan curtly. "They like each other, your father and Simon, don't they? Lavrans will like me less."
Kristen took these words to mean that Erlan understood she would still have a difficult path ahead of her before they had settled everything, and she was grateful for that. But he didn't return to this topic. He was overjoyed and said he had been afraid she wouldn't have the courage to speak to Simon.
"I can see that you're fond of him, in a way," he said.
"Does it matter to you?" asked Kristen. "After all that you and I have been through, that I realize Simon is both a just and capable man?"
If you had never met me, said Erland, you would have enjoyed good days with him, Kristen. Why do you laugh?
Oh, I'm thinking about something that Fru Astil once said, replied Kristen. I was only a child back then, but it was something